Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my very special guest, Bob Scott, former co-founder of Kansas City Fellowship and the author of Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer. Bob, it's good to have you on again. We were talking yesterday about the subject matter that we're getting into today, and I have to say I'm extremely excited. I have wanted to talk about this forever, but I've been waiting for the right moment with the right person to talk about it because it is a little bit complicated and delicate. And the irony of this, after I spoke with you, I'm doing, through this detangling IHOP KC, I'm working with Jed, I guess you know. And yeah. Jed wanted to do the same exact topic, and we're doing it later today. So I'm recording both today with two different people. So we're going to get three different perspectives on the same complex mess. We probably still won't untangle it because this is very complicated, but we'll get... I'm not sure which one will go out first, either yours or his, but we'll get a consensus of at least three heads together on the same subject.
Well, and plus you're getting a generational perspective, which is always very healthy, right? Because what my generation saw and how we interpreted things and how our kids did, you know, he's the same age as my children. So it's always fascinating to hear their perspective on things.
Yeah, it's... And I have a unique perspective, I guess. You guys were actually closer to the situation than I was. You know, I got to see it firsthand through certain individuals. I think you probably had a closer view on it. But anyway, the subject for the listeners, we're talking about the unusual things that we saw and heard and witnessed while being around these people who were so-called prophets. You know, growing up, we truly thought that these guys were the closest thing to God, at least in my sect we did. Mm-hmm. And what I've come to realize, even back then while I was in it, I realized that many things that they said were not really prophecies. They were just randomly saying things, and they would say it just, they had this knack for saying it just vague enough that if it didn't happen, you really didn't think about it. You didn't care that it didn't happen. But if it did, because of the way in which they said it, you went, oh my gosh, he knew. How did he know?
Right. Well, one of the biggest problems I ended up dealing with the prophetic guys is people couldn't discern or separate between what was a prophecy and what was their personal opinion. Right.
Absolutely.
So I give you a classic example of that, marriage. Right. So if because I've had a situation recently where this was the case, where somebody said, well, Paul Cain, you know, prophesied to my parents that they should stay married, and then I got abused. Well, yeah. I said, number one, you were a child, so you don't actually know what really happened. And number two, was that a prophecy or was that Paul Cain's theology based on his Assembly of God background, believing that divorce was a sin? So therefore, he's saying stay together. That was his opinion. That was his theology. That was his worldview. But, you know, people cross those boundaries all the time.
Absolutely. I've watched the same kind of thing. You know, if you can get the listener to believe that there is a consequence to the action that is spiritual, and then inject your spiritual ideas and beliefs and rules and boundaries around that, well, then suddenly they're going to make the connection in their head and go, oh my gosh, I did this, therefore the consequence is. Now, sometimes that's true. You know, if somebody is going to, I don't know, go rob a gas station, the consequence is probably they're going to jail if they get caught. That's a natural thing. But these people add spiritual consequences, and it's almost like if you put it into the spiritualist world, it's like if you rub a rabbit's foot, you get good luck. Well, these guys give you the opposite of rabbit's feet. And so you walk around thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to rub the opposite of a rabbit's foot and I'm going to catch this bad luck and it's going to destroy my life.
Well, one thing I think that's difficult about, you know, our conversation, what you alluded to earlier, is that we're trying to parse wheat and tares. And I'm using a biblical reference because I think it's sort of a word picture of what we're struggling with here, which is wheat and tares look identical.
Yeah.
Right? But one's a wheat and one's, you know, a wheat. And so they're different, but they look the same. So here we are, the two of us, trying to deconstruct our history with broken clay vessels who seem to have things happen that could be God, were good, people's lives were blessed, touched, you know, good things happen, and at the same time, really bad things happened.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do we unpack this, right? And so I think one of the things I appreciate about our conversations is we're like two guys trying to look at something going, what was that? Like, what did we see? What was this? And what's hard about a lot of it is you actually have to drill down and get to the root of it. Right. It's, you know, as I've said before, you know, it gets down to the nature of a thing, right? A wheat and a tare seed probably look identical, right? But one's a wheat, one's a tare, right? They grow up, they even look alike. But what's the nature of this thing? And so that's where I've been trying to deconstruct my life and looking back at some of this. And then I realized that, gosh, like good and bad, good and evil, they all are happening at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And right? You know, the same guys that were absolutely setting people free from their own inner demons, so to speak, were the same guys being manipulative and controlling people.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you have to humanize it also, because I'm certain it was this way maybe after you left in Kansas City and maybe while you were there. But the way that these men have projected their image and their stage persona, they become greater than human. And to the eyes of the people, these guys are the next thing to God. They call them the apostles and whatnot. But it's a human problem. In these movements, we have taken the personalities of the people and associated them to God. And so it's one or the other. It's either all on or on, all off. And, you know, you could take a person who spent an entire life doing really good deeds, helping the poor. Their entire life, if you were to sum it up, was good things. But they had this one moment in their life where they did a really, really bad thing. Maybe nobody was looking and they stole some money. Well, in the way that they teach the people in these cults, these two can't coexist. The person is either all good or they've never done bad, or they're all bad. But one of the ways I try to explain it when I'm working with people offline, and it's kind of a semi-heretical thing to say, so I'm going to be cautious how I say this, but the Apostle Paul was a human, and we regard him as an apostle. And if you read the Bible, you can read about the Apostle Paul. But say that he did something like this. Well, he's still a human. It doesn't mean that everything that he said was bad. It means that this one thing that happened, if it happened, would be bad. Because he is a human, like I'm a human. But this religion has trained the minds to think of apostles as this higher status than a human. Yeah. And they can do no wrong. Well, that's simply not true. Then, further amplify the problem, these guys have created stage personas for themselves where they want to stay in that level where they're above everybody else. And so they enjoy when people are looking up to them. Well, once they get to that level, nobody can live perfectly. You're human. So you're going to make mistakes. Now, that's not to say that, you know, the issues with Bickle are obviously long-standing, and there's a lot more than just a single incident. But what I'm trying to say is we have to humanize the person to understand the problem that we're about to address, which we'll get into further.
Well, even Paul admitted in Romans, I do things I don't want to do. Like he was struggling with his own humanity, right? He was like, I do stuff I don't want to do. I want to add to your thought here, because I think there's two sides to this equation that creates the problem. On the one side, what you talked about is the, broken clay vessels who are insecure, who want to be adored and be seen as, you know, elite or at a different plane or whatever, right? But the other side of the equation is we humans have this need, it seems, for heroes. And so I think it's a combination of two things, because it's not just in the church world, right? I mean, if you look at social media, I wrote about this. If you look at social media, the most popular people on Instagram that are being followed are people who are doing nothing to change or better the world. They're all people who are living this idyllic, well, perceived idyllic life, right? And they're all famous and they sing or they're movie stars or whatever, right? And so, you know, you have 30 million people following every move they make every day. And so I think this is particularly true in the Christian community as well. It's like, you know, I know we're supposed to be different, but we're really not. I mean, that's one of the, you know, at my age now, as I look back over things, it's like, actually, we're just a Christian veneer, because underneath we're just the same people as everybody else in our community, driven by all the same problems and needs and desires, right? And so we have the same need for spiritual heroes.
Yeah.
And so you take that combination of this human need, you know, for, you know, a deliverer, messiahs, right? People that are going to come and save us from our ordinariness. You know, people who we can live vicariously through and pretend we're somebody we're not, or whatever all the motivations are, we do that. So you take people that need heroes with people who want to be heroes, and what do you have? A mess. It's a collision, really.
Yeah. And then to further complicate this, which we talked briefly, and maybe we'll explore it a bit more, but the humans themselves are so complex. And so we're talking specifically in this podcast about the unusual things, the prophecies, etc. Well, you can study this, and there are various studies if you just search on the internet, but people who have mental health conditions often have unusual things happen to them. Are they supernatural? I don't know. Many of the books ask the question, is it, you know, could it be? And you look at, you know, some of the people who were regarded as non-Christian prophets, some of them had some issues, you know, mentally. And so there is this weird connection. It doesn't, for me, I still go back and forth between, do they really have some gift, or are they like the examples that I'm aware of? Are they just saying random things because they're half crazy and people are assuming that the half crazy things are coming to pass? I don't know. That's a question that will probably never be answered. But you have to also consider the fact that if it is possible that the mental health causes either the scenario of people believing that it's prophetic or they're actually having some sort of a spiritual insight, that further complicates this discussion.
Well, even historically, I mean, this may surprise some people, but it was 1500 years after Jesus left this earth before humanity even discovered there was a micro world. Like nobody in the Bible, not Apostle Paul, nobody in the New Testament understood there was a world of viruses, bacterias. Nobody would have understood DNA, chemical imbalance, like none of that stuff, right? Yeah. If somebody had epilepsy, right, it was always a spirit, right? Well, the other thing where this gets sort of interesting is there are people who had, that were epileptic, that had visions. Well, to the, you know, the mind who doesn't understand the micro world, and they're watching this person suddenly start shaking and their eyes rolling back in their head, and then they come out of this thing and then they talk about the vision that they had. Well, they think it's experience from God, right? In other words, they would have nobody would have ever said, oh, they have epilepsy.
Yeah.
Right. No, a spirit came on them. Look, they're shaking. Look at their eyes. They're having a spiritual experience. And look, now they even had a vision. So I've been saying, you got to be careful here in, you know, and contextualize some of this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, nobody in the New Testament would have understood that Jesus may have been actually healing people who had infections.
Oh, yeah.
They were all had a spirit, right?
Yeah.
So one thing, you know, one thing that I think would be interesting to talk about is Bob Jones' relationship with Mike. And here's why. I want to share a story. I want to share a perspective on something that then we can jump off from there. One of the things that was really hard for me in the 1980s was Mike and I, you know, we met at Bible school. I was 18. He was 19. You know, we were the two single guys, you know, sleeping in the same house, having conversations, you know, talking about our dreams and everything. Up till Bob Jones showed up, everything that Mike and I talked about that we felt, we always talked about it in the context was, well, I have this feeling or I have a sense or, you know, here's a biblical verse, right? And, you know, it was very real and, you know, and all that. When Bob Jones showed up in 1983, I watched my best friend change. And in hindsight, looking back at it, it was hard. I mean, it ultimately ended up in our relationship actually fracturing rather painfully. But what happened was, and this is me now looking back at 60 years old at this time, and what I realized was that on the one hand, you had Mike, who comes from a broken double alcoholic family, who's got an addictive personality, right? He's obsessive. Whatever Mike does, he excels at, whether it was sports or anything. He was so competitive and addictive, right? So he's got this personality that's addictive. Plus then he's also got this need to be a hero because that's how his dad wired him, right? Then Bob Jones shows up and Bob Jones affirms the fact that Mike's a hero. You know, that he's a spiritual warrior that's going to lead a movement, right? And or my brain started to go in this thing, which is going to sound odd to people, but hear me out here. It was like Bob Jones was like a prophetic drug pusher. I know this is going to sound weird with people, but you have an addict over here, right, who's desperately, you know, wanting to be this heroic sort of King David figure, right? This spiritual warrior, prayer warrior, you know, fighting for God. And then you've got this guy over here who has enough things happen that gives you some sense of like, he really might legitimately see things, right? Well, he's telling Mike everything Mike wants to hear. Right. And I'm watching this whole thing going on. Right. And I'm realizing there's this weird symbiotic relationship developing because Bob keeps feeding Mike, right, all these things to keep bolstering up everything that Mike needs to be and wants to be. Yeah. And that's where for me, it went off the rails, meaning that it's like, how can you trust any of this?
Yeah.
Right. Because Mike's got the platform, right? Mike's dynamic personality, it's so strong. I mean, I don't know if I've ever met somebody that has a more powerful gift of influence than Mike. He can walk into a room, right, and completely turn people 180 degrees and, you know, and they go from, we don't like you to, where do we sign up? I mean, he's got that kind of chutzpah, you know what I mean? He's got that kind of charisma about him, right? Well, then you've got Bob Jones over here that's sort of this orphaned human being who's desperately trying to fit in somewhere. He doesn't fit in anywhere. And then he comes and meets Mike, and then suddenly there's this powerful connection because they need each other, because Bob wants Mike's platform. You know, Bob wants, but it's driven by this need for acceptance, right? This need to belong, this need. I mean, and he was so honest with me about it. You know, it's like he just wanted to be a part of a family.
Yeah.
Right? But yeah. In order to do that, he had to keep feeding Mike these prophetic drugs, right, to keep Mike going.
You know, prophetic drugs is kind of funny. I've been trying to find a way to describe exactly what you're saying. In my research, it's not just with Branham. It's not just with Bickle. I see this over and over and over in the research. And I get, you've probably seen it in the comments, and you've probably heard it from people as well. People will look at something like this that purely is off the rails, and they will say, well, that man got possessed by an evil spirit and he's a demon and all of this stuff, which maybe, I'm not going to discredit that. However, what I see is exactly what you're saying. I just haven't created a label yet. When you have a charismatic personality who's feeding on this from the people, and so the people are supporting him, lifting him up, pushing him up onto a platform, then you get another similar personality who is not only doing the same thing, but bolstering the other guy. Then they start bolstering each other. Well, then they go even higher. And after they go higher, they realize, hey, there's power in this. We need more people. Let's bring in another one and another one. And they do this. And pretty soon what you get are the people, the prophets are affirming each other. And they're lifting each other up. The people have no idea, because unlike you, myself, Jed, who see what's happening in the environment around these guys, the casual person doesn't see that. And so they think, oh my gosh, God has come down in our midst. And as far back as I can go in my research, I mean, go back whenever Dowie began to lose his mind. He went off the rails. John Alexander Dowie. You had this swarm of prophets in Zion City trying to take over his, what was it, $10 million? It was a lot of money back then. So they're all swarming in, trying to get a hold of that money. and the newspapers reported the city's just overrun with prophets. And they're all doing this. Well, what happened is you've got John G. Lake, Bosworth, Charles Fox Parham, This group of men banded together, and they did exactly what you're saying. And then they believed that they could physically cast out the evil spirits, and they started killing people in these exorcisms. And they call it, you can go look it up, it's the Zion City Murders. The most horrific, this crippled, crooked woman, they tried to straighten her legs and snapped her femur. And I mean, it was a terrible, terrible death that they caused on this woman. And so in the aftermath, you look back at all of these people and you think, were they so evil that they wanted to kill people? No, but they banded together. Like you're saying, they got in this weird state of religious ecstasy, which is like a drug. It has the effects of being on a drug. They lift themselves up, they lift each other up. And the people who are suffering, in this case, suffering unto death, they don't see what's happening, but they think this is God.
Yeah. Again, I'm one of these people that likes to drill down to the root of things. And there's a part of me that's just, what's the word? It's like I have compassion for all the components. And what I mean by that is we humans are so desperate to know God sees us. You know what I mean? That God, he sees us. He knows me. He loves me, right? We're so desperate for some sort of affirmation from heaven that we matter, right? So there's a vulnerability in all of our souls to, you know, this need we have, right? Then you have leaders out there who we want to be our heroes, to reaffirm and see it, right? So it's like, well, if we don't get that from God, then we turn to humans. You know, and so here we are looking for heroes that we want to be associated with because we all want to be around success. And then you have heroes who want to be heroes, right? There's that whole type of personality that, you know, that loves to be the center of attention. And then over here, you have people that are reinforcing all that, you know, and it's a mess, really. It's like a collision. I mean, this sounds funny, but it's like a collision of need, right? It's like all these needs all colliding together. And I think that's where we become vulnerable. And I think over the years, what I've realized is I got to find God for me. Like, the reason I'm vulnerable, the reason I was open to so much is because I didn't have a sense of my own. I didn't have a sense of a strong sense of my own relationship with God. Right. In other words, it's sort of like when you're insecure and you feel like you need something, you go outside, right, and get it and try to put it, bring it in, right? That's what we do. It's like when we feel empty, we go somewhere and we grab something to fill our emptiness. And it can be good things or bad things. But when you find God for yourself, you don't need it. And one of the things that I've been fascinated with people that have read my book, is some of the people that are my age are reading it, but they're sort of emotionally detached. And the reason is because they had their own walk with God. Like Mike and Bob Jones, you know, they came, they saw it all, but they didn't need it. You know what I'm saying? It's the need that makes us vulnerable. And it's the need that a lot of these guys prey on. I mean, that's how con men work, right? They're so good at seeing the broken human side of us and the need we have. And then they come along and they tell us just what we want to hear. That's what made me start going, wait a minute here. This is getting a little incestuous here. Yeah. Right? It's like we're prophesying about ourselves. You know what I'm saying? It's like this isn't coming from the outside. This isn't coming from people that have no dog in the hunt, right? As they say. You know what I mean? We're prophesying with prejudice.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
You know, when I was studying Branhamism, there were two key elements that I think the vast majority of Latter Rain just totally missed. And the first one is, he considered himself a great teacher towards the end of his ministry, and that's how the entire movement spun up, because now they're following his teaching instead of the Bible. But he made this, he would frequently make the statement that gave people the correct warning. He said, I don't know the book real well, I just know the author. And he's referring to the Bible, right? I don't know what I'm teaching, is what he's telling the people. And the people, like you said, had such a need. Most of them sick and needy. That's why they were in this healing revival. So they were looking beyond their common sense because they were in this need, and they were totally ignoring the man who's telling them, don't listen to my teaching because I know nothing. The other thing he said was, I'm not a prophet. You said that. And he would frequently say this, right? Mm-hmm. He is aware mentally, in the early years at least, that he's just randomly pulling statements out of his butt and people are thinking they're prophecies. And then people are saying, oh, you must be a prophet. And he's, I never said I was a prophet. You said that. And he would continuously say this. Well, like you said, because there is such a need, these people that were joining into the healing revivals were suffering. Many of them, you know, they didn't have today's medicine, so many of them were going to die. That's how bad it was. They were looking for anything that could heal them or their neighbor or their loved one, whoever it was that they were there for. So they're joining into these things, and they're totally forgetting common sense because they have a need. And the person that they're going to is telling them, look, I'm not this thing that you're telling me that I am. But the problem is, over time, because they're human, he's aware of this in the early years. If you look in the later years, he was just bat crazy, and he started to believe the things that people were convincing him of. And I see a lot of that also with Mike Bickle.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
Well, one of the things that's sort of eye-opening to me that kind of tells you how desperate people are is even when people are exposed to having less than stellar character, but if they display any sort of supernatural, I don't even know what the word I'm trying to say, but any, you know, they model any sort of supernaturalness, people just overlook everything just to get to that, right? I see it all the time. It's like just people just, what's the word? They compartmentalize it, right? It's like, I'm so desperate for God. I'm so desperate to be healed. I'm so desperate to get a word from God. I'm so desperate for God to touch me or whatever. I don't really care if he slept with so-and-so. You see what I mean? It's this, and it gets back to the, I know I keep saying this phrase, but I just see it everywhere. The end justifies the means. It's like, it's not like we have these core values, morals, and ethics, right, that govern us. It's the need that drives us. And we'll actually compromise our morals, values, and ethics to fulfill the need, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of, when I look at that and I see that, I just, you know, I think of what Jesus did when he looked, you know, at the masses. You know, it's like it says he knew what was in their hearts. That's why he didn't give himself to them. Right. It's like Jesus understood the crowd. You know, it's like, you know, and I think Jesus dealt with that. It's like, work us another miracle, Jesus. Right. Do another signs and wonder, Jesus. You know, it's like I think Jesus understood the people were following him because they were just desperate.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't think half the time they even understood what he was talking about. I think Jesus is better understood in hindsight.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, it makes sense later. It probably didn't make a whole lot of sense at the moment because people are like, I'm hungry. Feed me. Right. I'm broken. Mend me.
Yeah.
The need drove it. And I look at it now and I see the same thing in these churches. You know, it's like the need. So that's where my heart, that's why I don't get real judgmental about it. Cause it's just like, let's just see this pain in people, this desperation, this need. Right. And they'll just do whatever. They'll rip the roof off to get healed. Right.
Yeah. You know, it's a problem that whenever the men get into this position where the people start regarding them as a seer or a prophet, and maybe they have had some insight, who knows? I'm not going to say that they didn't, but say that the people accept that they did, well, then they begin to expect it. And as a human, the human wants to feed that need for those people. So, you know, we've had this conversation offline, and ironically, I've had the same exact conversation with probably 10 people who knew Paul Kane at this point.
Yeah.
There, you get into this rhythm of you have to come up with something, and what do you come up with? And these guys are doing things like,
right? What's going on there, right? There's an expectation put on these guys.
Absolutely.
And it's coming from two directions, right? It's like, so if you're a Paul Kane or a Bob Jones or any one of these guys, you are stuck on a state. Like, you know, and this gets back to even how we do church and why we do, right? It's like there's this whole model. That's one of the things I'm wrestling with in the book, right? It's like our whole model of church, this whole idea of a stage and an audience, right? Because it creates all kinds of vulnerabilities. So now you're sticking a guy out there, right, who's got a perceived gift.
Yeah.
And he's actually sandwiched. And he's sandwiched because in front of him is 5,000 people all going, work us a wonder.
Oh, yeah.
Show us the supernatural, right? So he's got a whole audience out there. Sitting behind him is a whole group of leaders going, work us a wonder.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Reaffirm who we are, right? You know, we need a big offering. You know, I actually had somebody send me an email the other day. It's crazy, but it's Mike telling Paul Kane that if he'll come here and prophesy to people, he can make lots of money.
I don't doubt it.
Right, but you see the pressure? So again, you know, I know people want to vilify a Bob Jones or they want to vilify a Paul Kane or whatever. I see it differently. I see this as these poor, insecure human beings, you know what I mean, that are so desperate to be loved, who might have something unusual going on. There's no doubt about it, right? There's something odd that's different that these guys have, and yet we're putting him out there. I think I told you this story of a supposed prophetess who got caught putting gold dust in her Bible. And when she was confronted with it, her argument was, well, I need to get the audience into faith. So yeah. As we've discussed, this may be interesting for your audience, but most of the charismatic Pentecostal latter rain guys all had a worldview, and the worldview was, or their theology was, faith unlocks the supernatural. So therefore, the object of the exercise is to get the audience into faith. Well, if God's not moving, right, if there's not something already there, what they did was they faked it.
Yeah.
And the justification was, if we can fake it and get the people to believe, they'll be in faith. And so the end justifies the means. So there was this whole thing that entered into the ministry world, and it's everywhere, and I see it all the time now, is the end justifies the means. We can cheat on the front end, because it'll all work out on the back end, right? And I think that's gotten so infiltrated the ministry mindset that I think we're in a dangerous place right now. I keep seeing it everywhere, right? I keep seeing this, like, you know, we're gonna present something, and if we can just get everybody over here,
yeah, it's a complicated problem because, like you said, these people, they had something, whether it's a mental health issue or whatever it is, they had something that was inspiring them to do this. Then they got up to the next level, and it was like they had to feed the need of doing it. And there came a point in which the conscience became seared, because once a person gets to the level where they are knowingly misleading people, there's a point in which your conscience is telling you, don't do this, this is wrong. But because of the stage act and all of the people feeding on it, there came a point in which the conscience just was completely shut off. I'm going to continue doing this. And like you said, I can tell you sermon after sermon titles from Branham where he's saying exactly that. You got to get into the faith, and that unlocks the door for these great miracles and prophecies and whatnot. But you know, on my website, if you type in, I think it's Darren Brown, you can find, there's this famous atheist who creates a fake stage act of a faith healer, gets all of these people in here. He is an atheist, but he's doing the same exact rhythm, style, charisma, and there are people who are actually getting healed in his meeting. And at the end, he calls them all in the room and he says, look, this whole thing was fake. I just wanted to show you. Well, you couldn't even convince them that they didn't get healed. So there's this element where it's almost like a numbers game. You get a bunch of people in a room. Well, 1 out of 10 is going to have something happen because you're human and you don't know, you know, God heals people without the stage act. You know what I'm saying? So you can't really tie it to the person, but these people they end up having a seared conscience where they don't care if they can get them into the hype. Then they're going to believe it's them. And here's the problem that I have. You know, like I said, I talked to several people who knew Paul Kane.
the guy was doing things like reading stacks and stacks of phone books so he could get names and addresses and phone numbers. And that was one of the same gimmicks Branham used. I know your name. I know your address. I know your, you know, I don't know if you use phone number, but he would always have something that would elevate their faith before he would issue a quote unquote healing. And there were people who actually got healed. I know people who got healed in these things. So was it mind over matter? Was it God? I don't know. I'm not here to say. But when we can clearly identify that these guys were using fraudulent gimmicks to elevate their faith, what I can say is they did have a seared conscience.
Yeah. My view of it is it's a mixture. I think they all had something. Again, I'm still trying to figure out what that something was. Because the same something they had, there's all kinds of people outside the church that have the same something. And so it's kind of like, okay, well, wait a minute here. If that's true, which it is, then what is this, right? Because it's always assumed that it's the Holy Spirit. And I'm like, huh, that's interesting because they don't have the Holy Spirit over here and they're doing the same thing. So it's kind of like, that's a head scratcher. But, and people have to forgive me, but I'm sort of fearless. I'm a little bit like Toto on The Wizard of Oz. It's like, don't mind the man behind the curtain.
Yeah.
If you say that to me, I'm going behind the curtain. Like, I just have this
I'm the same way.
I'm like, have this need to understand, right? So I just keep tearing things. Like, I keep peeling the onion because I'm going to keep going at it until I get to the root of it because I want to know what this is. I want to understand what's going on. And I'm not afraid to challenge a lot of the assumptions, right? There's so many assumptions. One of the things that's really dangerous, and I think, it's to your point, the Christian community is very siloed. And the Pentecostal charismatic world, it's an echo chamber, right? It's like you're in this isolated world where you're with a whole bunch of people that kind of think the same way. Well, then break that down even further, and you get all these leaders together, right? And they have, it's called groupthink. I mean, I'm an amateur sociologist, so I kind of understand how it works. So you get all these leaders together, right? And they start, and there's a pecking order, right? There's always a pecking order at these leadership meetings. And, and so if the guy at the top, if Branham's an end justifies the means guy, right? Then everybody underneath becomes an end justifies the means guy. And then a whole movement, whether it's KCF or whether it's Latter Rain, all starts thinking, okay, well, I guess it's okay to fake it on the front end.
Yeah.
Right. And they'll keep faking it, right, until they think the real thing happens, right? And it's always the thing I always heard was the angel's going to show up. We're waiting for the angel to show up.
Yeah. That was the other thing that was really telling for me. You probably saw it too. And I'm curious to understand if Jed had the same experience, but these guys would make these claims, right? And they truly believe what it is they're claiming. That's the other odd thing. Whenever you're looking at these guys and you think, well, they're complete frauds, I don't see it that way. They really believe some of the things that they're saying, even though it's fraudulent. That's the where it gets really weird. But the thing that was really telling for me is whenever they would say it and it happened, they were as shocked as could be that it happened. It was like, oh my gosh, that thing I just said, wow. So you could clearly tell that before they said it, before they announced it to the people, they really didn't believe it themselves, but they said it, and then it was like they were trying to command it to happen. And then it happened, and they're like, oh, wow, did you see that? And when you're there to see all of this, it looks entirely different than if you only see the quote-unquote prophecy and the fulfillment. When you see all of it, you're like, yeah, I don't know about that, man.
Well, to your point, when Mike and I started, right, like when he recruited me to come with him to Kansas City, and he's telling me about his experience in Egypt. Well, I had this impression while I was in Cairo and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm tracking. Well, by time we get to the late 80s, now Mike had a word from God in Cairo.
Yes.
And I think you understand where I'm going with this, because these stories, right? But here's why. And this is what I'm saying. This was the hard thing for me to watch. It was like, as you know, that, you know, Bob Jones's influence on Mike was, it was no longer good enough to say, you know, I had this feeling God was saying something to me. Two, now I have to say, God spoke to me in an, I was taken to the third heavens. You know, I had a dream. You know what I mean? The whole thing got, you know, what's the word? It just got accelerated, you know, or elevated into this whole thing where now Mike's a prophet, right?
Yeah.
Because he's wanting to, you know, even though I got Paul Kane and Bob Jones telling me Mike's got zero discernment, like none, like it's like doesn't even register discernment. Right. And now suddenly Mike's got all these spiritual revelations. And I'm looking at this going, what's happening to my friend? That's what I'm saying. It was like he's had this addictive personality and he became addicted to this thing. Well, it's the same thing with the prophetic guys on the other side. Right. You know, it's like Bob Jones. When I first met him, all Bob Jones, this is what so was, it's, and I almost could cry about this because it was so sweet. All he wanted to do was heal people. Like, yeah. He was just this blue collar dude, right? I mean, he was just a dude. Like, he just wasn't special. And he didn't see himself as special, right? He just saw himself as this blue collar guy that somehow or another had this bizarre experience. And like, he started knowing things and he didn't really even understand why he did. He just know it started after he got struck by lightning. And whatever it is that he felt seemed to touch people's hearts. And that's what he wanted to do. Like, he wanted to heal people. The minute he got connected with Mike, and Mike started to put him on a platform, because Mike needed to elevate Bob Jones, right? To what? Elevate himself. That's that's the equation that people don't fully understand. It's the same thing if you go back and study history. In every civilization, you have government and you have religion. Right. And so it's always the king and the pope, the king and the high priest, king or whatever, king of the prophets. And it's like these are the two power structures. Right. And sometimes they're fighting each other and sometimes they're in bed with each other. Well, in this, you know, situation, we needed the prophetic and the priestly, you know, if you call Mike the priestly side of the, those two things had to come together. Yeah. And so there's this weird symbiotic relationship that I think was like drug induced, like this whole supernatural prophetic thing. That's why I watched Mike change, right, to where he ended up, in my view, having an overinflated view of himself, right? It's like, you know, all these guys were coming to Kansas City and telling Mike how wonderful he was, how special he was, how unique he was, how he was going to, you know, be this leader of this movement to change the world. Like, they were reaffirming everything Mike wanted to believe about himself. So he just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, his ego just got so huge. That's why, you know, a lot of people now realize how narcissistic he was, right? And even the way he ended up not listening to people like who had expertise, like people that were really gifted in other areas, he always believed he knew more than they did. Yeah. And I used to have constant conversations with these guys, some of them, you know, super successful business guys, going, I don't get it. I don't understand. I say, you know, there's no room for you in his soul. Like, his ego is so big, there's no space for anybody else, right? And then you see Bob and Paul and all those guys, you know, so desperate themselves, and Mike's putting him on a stage, and they're all thinking this is wonderful, not realizing they're being used.
Yeah. Well, right? And it's even more complicated than used. So this is another thing I've been wrestling how to explain it, and there really isn't a good way. I'm going to try here, but there's this other problem that exists. You talked about the Cairo thing, you know, how you were there, he came back, and then it grew into this wonderful, fabulous, nonsensical thing. Well, any of my peers who are studying Mike Bickle and the whole thing, they'll just say he outright lied. He lied about that. That's not true. That didn't happen. But it's not so simple as that. Right. Whenever you've got people that are like we explained, they're feeding off of each other. The best example I can give, it even happens at a much lower level in these movements, because they're looking for something that is far beyond the understanding of the human mind to exist, because they're wanting a miracle. They're wanting this thing. Yeah. So I have a cousin who I've mentioned him a few times in my podcast. I would not be alive today if not for him. He saved my life, and he unfortunately died during COVID. He caught COVID. But he was no longer a member of the Branham Church, and he is one who, as I was struggling through the worst of it, he was calling me every day to help me out, and I was asking him, Marcus, why aren't you a believer of the prophet? Well, long story short, years after all of this happened, he explained to me the exact reason why he left the church. And he said that he and a group of the brethren, that's how we called each other, they went on a canoeing trip, and they got caught in some very, it wasn't rapids, but it was, you've been in water that's just really gushing, right? So he got in this place where it's going really, really fast, and it got dangerous. And my cousin was a huge, really built guy. He only had like, I want to say 10% body fat, big old guy, black belt in karate. He almost single-handedly saved everyone. I mean, it was a collaborative effort, but there was a lot of muscle involved with keeping these people alive or from disaster, whatever would have been the outcome. So what happens is, after this, the guys are together on, you know, going out to eat or whatever it is, and they talk about this event that happened. And then one guy just happens to say, well, this happened, and I prayed to God, and yada, yada, yada. Started this, that element of the story grew. Well, then another person started feeding off of that element. You know, I had the same exact thought as you. And I don't know how all this came to be. I'm just giving an example. Over time, after feeding on themselves, as one person is planting a seed of thought into another person's head, that person is watering that seed, accepting another seed from another guy. Well, the story grows in their minds, and you cannot convince a single one of them that this is not the way it happened. In the end, one guy got up in front of the church and told the testimony, and basically presented himself as like the spiritual savior of the whole crew, because he had had this divine thing happen in his head right at the last minute. And so my cousin, who's the one who actually saved them, is sitting in the church, and here's this guy gets on the platform and says that God worked through him a miracle. And he's like, oh, wow. Heck no, man, that is not what happened. He got up and walked out and never came back, he said. So the irony of this, so you've got one person, my cousin, who left, never came back, and says all those guys are just liars. But he wasn't among the groups where they were talking to each other. Then you've got the spiritual leader who's on the platform saying, God worked this miracle through me. We've got all of his supporters who are still in the church that were part of this unit that were collaborating the story in their heads. They believe it, man. That's exactly what happened. Amen, brother. You can't convince them otherwise. Then take a step outside of this entire church to anybody who's not in this charismatic Pentecostal weirdness. They're saying, those guys are crazy, man. And and you can't convince the guys that experienced it. They experienced it. That is their experience. So when they're telling it, they're telling what they believe to be true. The people on the outside think they're lying through their teeth. And you got one guy who's, he left that religion. He did not become atheist, but he left that religion. So to them, he's their atheist. Totally doesn't believe it because he knows the entire series of events. So you and I are kind of in a unique perspective because we have seen things like this happen. Yeah. And how do you explain this to somebody? You try to explain it to people who are caught up in it. You can't convince them otherwise.
Well, I know from sociology and psychology that your present state of mind impacts how you tell a story from your past. I mean, this is, you know, this isn't even debated in those circles. So you can, you know, people sometimes are shocked because somebody will tell the same story about the same event, and it sounds like they're was like, wait a minute, the last time you said this, it was something totally different, right? But what science has discovered is that where you are at the time you're telling the story impacts how you then interpret the data and your experience in your head. So you'll change your story, but it's really you're changing your perspective.
Yeah.
Right? If you would have asked those guys what had happened within 8 hours of that event, they would have all told your cousin's story.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Then you get time between it, and then they get on the other side of it. The fear is gone. The paranoia is gone. The I saw my life flash in front of my eyes is all gone now. And, you know, I'm feeling really, you know, like pretty good about myself. And then suddenly now the story all shifts and you get another whole different perspective. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's a psychology thing. And so that's, people don't understand that. I mean, it gets frustrating, particularly where you'll see it as in families. That's, you know, and I think everybody that's listening will understand what I'm talking about, because you can talk about Christmas in 1965 and you'll, you know, if you're a family of five, you'll get five different stories about what that Christmas looked like, right? Or what happened, or the Thanksgiving fight of 1984, you know what I mean? And it's like, well, it's, you know what I mean? It's just, we all, it's just, that's what I think we talked about this last time, perception, perspective, paradigm, right? Our senses, we see things, that data gets put into our brain, but then there's filters that it goes through and how we then interpret that data, right?
Yeah. It's very
and
complicated.
So that's why it happened with Mike, was the filter he had in 1982, right, was wait a minute, you know, I felt something and this is what I felt God told me. I mean, it was all an impression. Bring Bob Jones, Paul Kane, all these prophetic guys into the mix, and suddenly his perspective shifts.
Yeah.
And so now he's telling the same story through this whole prophetic thing, and now it's all of a sudden God, the audible voice of God, or whatever, however he tells the story now, right? You know, but it's, everything's exaggerated. So there's a situation right now that a lot of people have been talking about, which is kind of interesting. You know, IHOP bought some land not far from it that was once owned by the Truman family.
Wow.
And this whole thing is so interesting because, you know, Harry Truman, because of the fact that he was the one that basically told our, in the UN, you know, it's like voting for the statehood of Israel, and the Jewish people have always been very grateful for him, that somehow Harry Truman is this saint, like he's Saint Harry Truman, right? Because he was the one that it was during his administration that Israel became a nation. So out of that, there's all these things that have been extrapolated. So now this farmland that his father owned in Grandview, Missouri, somehow is got a special destiny on it. No, I'm just saying, it's sort of, see how where this stuff goes? It's like we're so desperate for something to mean something that suddenly now this farmland that Harry Truman farmed when he was a kid with his family, you know, they bought it from the Jewish family that owned it, and now they're all waiting to, you know, and Mike's going to have this great big comeback, and, you know, this land is going to be, you know, because it's God's land and it's consecrated and it's, right, this whole drama now around this piece of land. It gets crazy.
It's crazy.
No, but I'm just saying, it's like everything has to mean something more than what it is. So one of the things, you know, getting back to the whole Bob Jones thing, here's something that really bothered me. So Bob Jones comes to the church, right? And suddenly, you know, Bob's spends so much of his time telling people how he got his, you know, I had this dream. But everything was parabolic, right? It was like, I had this dream about this pumpkin and blah, 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 and then we did this and the seeds inside, right? And anyways, and then out of that, you know, there was this spiritual interpretation of what it meant. Well, suddenly, and this is what's so fascinating, was we were a church of so many young wannabes that suddenly now everybody wants to talk and be Bob Jones, right?
Yeah.
So now I'm in a community of 1,500 to 2,000 people, and like a huge portion of them can't carry on a conversation with you in ordinary human terms. It's like you walk into the church, well, I had a dream about you in the pumpkin patch and blah, 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 right? No, but it's just like, you know, and then, well, I saw the number 13 and it was here and it means, right? And so it was like every conversation was into this realm of trying to interpret these weird dreams and visions and numbers and, right? And that really bothered me. Because it's like we forgot how to like just be human.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the whole thing about Christianity is our love for one another and our humanity and caring for each other. And suddenly our whole culture became this weird world of dreams, visions, revelations, numerology. You know, nothing meant what it was.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is everything had to mean something else. And it was the spiritually elite who could interpret it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really hit me as I was beginning to make my exit. We were so caught up into the spiritual ecstasy, trying to look for things that weren't there. Numbers, yeah. I can't tell you how many. If I saw three doves, I was like, oh, it's a sign from God. Or if 13, yeah. 12, all of these weird numbers, you're like, oh my gosh, God is speaking to me because I can do simple math in my head. And I started to realize, man, this is not the way it's supposed to be. We're losing touch with reality. And yeah. I think that's really the problem for people who've never been in this, and they look on the outside, they see all of these people as, you know, lying through their teeth or whatever, but, and to some extent, maybe they are, but there's more, it's more complicated than that. These people are so caught up in this hype and this, right. Like you called it a drug, it has the effects of a drug on your head. So they're caught up in this, and what they end up with is not reality, but to them, it's very real. So on the outside, you're looking at this fantasy world, and they're living in the fantasy world. So, but we go on.
Just to close this up, I think there was two things going on. It's like, and this is where I think God's compassion comes in, because they are all thinking they're spiritual giants by communicating all this, their spiritual revelation. I think God looked down from heaven and goes, oh, you're so cute. It's like, you little children, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
You don't understand. It's like, these are not toys, but you're so immature. You're so childish. You see, and that's where I think the collision is. I think if we had understood back in the 1980s that God was having mercy on us because we were so broken and insecure and needy and whatever, right? That we had to suddenly pretend we were something we weren't. Like we were all, you know, we were all wannabe apostles and prophets.
Yeah.
And then God looked down from heaven and goes, I love you guys, but this is kind of embarrassing.
People are taking it too far.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been fun. We're going to have to break this one and pick up where we left off. There's so much more that we could talk about, but thank you so much for doing this.
No, I'm enjoying this, actually. It's fun to have somebody that thinks like I do, that's not afraid to kind of deconstruct all this.
Yeah. I'm not, it's not really for me even a fear thing. It's the more perspectives I can get from other people, the more I can understand what has happened to this Christian world as we know it. It's tainted. In many ways, it's just not, it's not what it should be. Like you said, they've turned into a stage and not audience, and that's not what it's supposed to be. So thank you for doing this. Yeah. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and soon Audible.